Keith Weiner, President of the Gold Standard Institute and CEO of Monetary Metals. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to The Competent Investor.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Keith, you guys recently put out the 2026 Gold Outlook, which you guys do every year. And I thought that this would be a good time to kind of go through what your expectations are for the year ahead and also kind of look back retrospectively at 2025. So why don't we start by looking back and trying to understand if the gold price, gold and silver prices, outpaced your expectations for last year?
Well, you just gave away the punchline. That's exactly it. I said we're in a bull market. I said this is not the bear market of second half of 2011 through 2018 into 2019. This is a whole different thing. This is durable. And, gold could hit. I think my target was $3,700. And silver, I think I said 37. And boy, did they. And more. And, I'll call that a victory because we're trying to be conservative. We're not trying to be sensationalists and say, here's an aggressive target or buy gold with leverage because, it's going to go up this much. Mm-hmm. We just want to say, look, this is what we see. And, if the price surpasses it, so be it. And obviously in silver, particularly in silver, boy, did that go way beyond 37 bucks.
Well, I'd like to kind of separate gold and silver for the moment. We'll get to silver, but do you see this as basically I guess it's not the start, but, steps along the way of currency competition and that being a massive driver for gold's demand over, let's say, the past 18 months?
I think there is a very small amount of use of gold as an actual means of payment. And, it's a very funny thing because the world is desperate for, I shouldn't say needs, it is what it is, but the world is desperate for a means of settlement that isn't the US dollar. They have a love-hate relationship with the dollar. They want dollars, they need dollars, they crave dollars in the way that a dope fiend, craves the drug. It isn't necessarily a healthy relationship, but the craving has a desperate, frantic urgency to it. But at the same time, there's a desire for something else. And, the world has to go through the all the other candidates and rule them out first. So, they're going to try bilateral, currency stuff. Russia was accepting rupees from India in payment for oil, and which I think was a stunt. I'm sure they realized it wasn't going to work. And then they said, no, we're not doing that anymore. And the Russian finance minister said, we're not going to accumulate a pile of useless rupees. That was his term, pile of useless rupees. It's not going to be the yuan, which also has capital controls as the Indian rupee does, and therefore not useful outside of China, really. They don't have the liquidity, they don't have the flows, they don't have any of the characteristics of the dollar. What was the quote from Sherlock Holmes? After you've eliminated everything, then what's left, no matter how improbable, is the answer. I'm butchering it, but it was something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, after you've tried everything else, now, before I finish that thought, everybody running the world's monetary system, whether it's people running the Fed, the Bank of England, Bank of Canada, People's Bank of China, ECB, they all go to the same universities and they get indoctrinated in the same, whether it's Keynes, whether it's Friedman, whether it's neoclassical, it's all the same dirigism, central planningism. And, which means a central bank and a fiat irredeemable currency. They all get the same, training, whether it's Oxford, Cambridge, London School of Economics, Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, University of Chicago, it doesn't really matter. They all get the same indoctrination. And They don't want gold. Nobody wants that. But it's the only thing that's going to be left standing at the end of the day. So, and I don't just mean that in the sense of, okay, there's going to be an apocalypse and then gold will survive. I just mean there's no other thing that they can use for settlement, or anything else for that matter in terms of international trade. And so there are a few instances where gold is being used to settle, trade. And I don't think that in itself is a driver of the price action. To get back to your question, it's far too small. Psychologically, it might be important. A lot of people might be buying gold, watching that. I don't really think so either. I think the buying of gold right now has to do with people fearing, the crash of their local currencies. The Chinese are buying gold because they don't trust the Chinese government. They don't trust the yuan, and they want an alternative, mostly dollars, by the way, but gold to a secondary, degree. The Turks. Let me deal with India a second. India has one of those currencies that is designed to go down, and it does so really well. I mean, it's going down against the dollar over long periods of time, like 8% a year against the dollar. And the dollar is going down against gold right now, obviously at a prodigious rate. So, in India, they don't think of, they don't think of the rupee as savings. It's a transactional currency, but savings is gold. And so I was interviewed recently by a reporter in India asking me about the attitude towards gold, in the US and in the West. And I said, well, in the US, I think less than 1% of people have any gold. And she was just like, really? How could that be? And I said, the response you just gave me is exactly the same as if I tell a reporter in America that 100% of people in India have gold. Really? What? How could that be? And so, you just get a completely different. Anyways, the Indians are not buying gold because they're afraid of the dollar collapsing. They're buying gold because they're certain that the rupee, if not hyperinflation collapse, is certainly going down predictably. And therefore, if you buy gold and you measure your gains in rupees, you're certain to do well, and you don't need a particularly long time frame to realize it. It's really only the Arabs that are buying gold out of uncomfortable concern for the dollar. Because their currencies are stable, they're pegged to the dollar generally, and those pegs are stable, unlike the rupee, the lira, and the yuan. Well, the yuan is somewhat stable, but not like the Arab currencies. And they have the leisure and the wealth. To be seen, because I mean, Turkey is a relatively poor country. China, there's wealth there, but an awful lot of people are pretty poor. India is, oh my God, is it poor? The Arab countries today, there's a lot of wealth, floating around. So they have the leisure and the wealth to be thinking about this in more abstract, academic, philosophical terms, right? And they're thinking about the dollar and eyeing it nervously. And buying gold for that reason. And so you have all that going on. Is that fueled by the use of gold as a currency? I think it's a little early for that to really have that much of an effect.
Keith, you mentioned the idea of not trusting the yuan by the Chinese people. Do you think that they have somewhat of the same attitude towards the dollar, even though it might be the cleanest dirty shirt, or is it specifically their distrust that also fuels their drive into gold?
I mean, I'm sure you can find, there's about 1 billion people in China. I'm sure you can find some people that would talk shit about the dollar. But, general, every person of any degree of wealth in China is, it's illegal to dump the yuan for dollars. They have capital controls. And, China's the kind of place where if you violate that in any serious way, they could disappear you to a secret prison. And break you and by whatever methods that an authoritarian regime would have. So they're risking their lives to dump the yuan and get dollars, and it's primarily dollars. I don't think no, I don't think it's largely fear that the dollar is going to collapse. I don't think they're looking at it that way. I'm sure there's some, I mean, of course, but no, by and large, it's an anti-yuan, trade.
You also mentioned this idea of stable pegs to the US dollar, and Tether is another one of these quote unquote currencies that is one to one pegged or backed to or pegged to the US dollar. With the advent of them buying so much gold, now they own more than many central banks of countries around the world. Is that also another symptom of gold competing in this marketplace of currencies and monies?
Yeah, and a very interesting one. I mean, you think about it, Tether is a native crypto company if ever there was one. And where do they put the profits? Yeah, I'm sure they all hold a lot of Bitcoin, but the fact that they hold any gold, let alone a lot of it, isn't that interesting? Isn't that telling? It's kind of like, a high percentage of public school teachers send their kids to Montessori school. It's saying something, versus whatever percentage of the population does it.
Yeah, it's the believe the actions, not necessarily the statements, right?
Well, but they're insiders. I mean, it's like the public school teachers, if they're sending their kids to private school, it's because they know.
So, Keith, how does silver fit into this framework of money as well? It's considered closer to be a commodity, let's say, for industrial use. Do we see examples of it returning to monetary uses of the past?
Well, I was going to say, let me quibble with the former. I mean, silver has, there's no question silver has industrial uses. But I disagree with the narrative that, industrial uses are consuming all the silver, which means essentially silver has been demonetized. That's what people are arguing, which, there's a component of the silver bugs and the analysts that any argument that leads to higher silver prices, that's what they're goal seeking to find. So they don't think of it in terms of demonetization, but that's exactly what it would be if solar panels and switch contacts or washing machines and antimicrobial fabrics and countertops were outbidding, silver stackers and consuming down the silver stocks. That would be demonetization of silver, which I don't agree with. But I shared a stage, right? I was a speaker at, I don't remember which conference this was. It could have been IPMI. I don't remember which year it was, whatever. But I shared a stage with somebody from Metals Focus. I think it was Philip Newman. And I don't remember what I was talking about, something about silver and, whatever. And because it was a panel on silver. And his presentation was all about, what does silver, and how does it trade, and what is the closest other thing that silver trades like? So he looked at first copper. It wasn't really a good correlation with silver and copper. He looked at crude oil. He looked at a few other commodities, wheat or something like that, and it just didn't really behave well enough that you could point. You could put the graphs up on the screen, you could see it, and then he pulled up gold. And lo and behold, silver traded much, much, much closer to gold than it did to any other, commodity. And so there you have it. It's still trading like money. So if anybody was wondering, has silver really been demonetized? No. And now it has come back screaming for vengeance. So two things are happening. The market is not valuing antique teapots and tableware and platters and forks and spoons and even junk silver and all that old silver jewelry. That's all going to the melt, and it's being valued like feedstock for melt. Market is valuing bullion bars and bullion coins, and so yeah, it's come back with a vengeance as monetary demand. Now, the other thing about silver is that you could have an aberration, and I think we did, where gold was cheap enough that the masses could have some gold. Gold was not too long ago at $1,000 an ounce. And $1,000 an ounce, working people can buy gold. It's, not out of the question. If they care to own some, they can. And that was never true historically. Gold was always out of reach. Now at $5,000 an ounce, it's much less reasonable, especially in the rest of the world. I mean, American workers are very highly paid. The rest of the world, not so much. So in India, minimum wage is between $2 and $5 a day, depending on what province you're in. And at that rate, they used to save up and buy gold, and now there's increasing substitution of silver. So they love silver too, not as much as they love gold, but they can't if they can't get gold, what are they going to do? Well, silver is the second best, option. So I think there's a lot of that going on. And for all the people that are cheering for industrial use to consume it, just imagine what is going on right now at every solar panel manufacturer, every manufacturer of switches and relays and all the other things, antimicrobial fabrics that use silver. They're all pushing their engineers for a product redesign to use less. Doesn't mean you can eliminate silver, but if you focus enough engineering cycles on it, you can reduce the silver usage. And you don't bother reducing silver usage at $25 an ounce. At $125 an ounce, you bet your bottom dollar they're doing it. And so, which means more monetary use, less industrial use, which makes sense. If you think about $125 silver, that makes sense, right?
So, this is an argument that I've heard a couple times over the last, let's say, 3 to 4 months here, that these higher silver prices are going to bring out a lot more recycling, a lot more production from, mothballed mines. And you bring up this other point of reducing industrial silver usage because of the cost of the feedstock. Does all of this combine to really quench the price? And if so, do you have any idea on, let's say, the timeline that it takes for much of this recycled silver, for example, to be able to satisfy that demand? Because, we always hear about the silver production deficit numbers, but that, we've heard about that for years upon years.
Decades, and you couldn't use that as an investment thesis to buy silver, that's for sure.
Well, you could, but
Since
it's not accurate.
since the late 1990s, I mean, silver's had its ups and downs, and plenty of downs. So if that was your investment thesis, that there's a real problem, and this is kind of a symptom of the dollar going off the rails, really. And I wrote about when gold backwardation becomes permanent. And now we have silver backwardation that isn't permanent backwardation, but there's backwardation that happens is happening in silver on and off. And backwardation just means higher cost to have. So if you're a refiner and someone wants to bring you a massive load of whether it's junk silver coins or whether it's unwanted silver platters and tableware, or whatever it may be, teapots. And you're gonna buy 100 tons of this stuff or whatever. You've got to hedge the price. I mean, you can't buy that at, last week we had, what was it, $85 almost? You can't buy it at $85, and now here we are below 80. I mean, you get creamed. The margins in refining just aren't that big. So you got to hedge it. Now the problem is when you have backwardation, the cost of hedging goes up massively. So October 20 was the worst day that I've seen so far in this recent cycle. I won't say it's the worst historically ever. It cost you $2.15 per ounce to hedge in October 20. And so, the margin refining silver isn't $2 an ounce. It isn't. So that forces the refiners to say, we don't want the metal. So the primary producers of metal to the bullion market are basically saying, no mas, right? What an incredibly perverse thing. I mean, the demand for their products at an all-time high, and the very demand for the product is causing them to not want to produce. And that's the dollar going off the rails. I mean, gold and silver should never be in backwardation. And the fact that it is showing that there's cracks in the system, fissures are developing. And there are many perverse outcomes that come of the perverse incentive. Backwardation is a perverse incentive. Any perverse outcomes of that, behaviors of perverse outcomes, and this is one of them. So in the short term, you may actually be driving silver away from the market rather than bringing silver into the market. So you get a positive feedback loop. But longer term, I don't think, I mean, if nothing else, all these guys will get a silver lease for monetary metals and they won't have that problem. Because if you're leasing the metal for monetary metals, then you don't need to hedge. You don't have that price risk. So all those teapots and silver platters and forks and spoons are going to come to market and be melted and become, maples and eagles and bullion bars, sooner or later and relatively soon. I mean, that's not a market that's going to take years and years. I mean, it won't take years and years for the refiners to process it. It may take years and years for people to bring all that stuff out of the basement, dust it off from underneath the old boxes. I mean, let's say you have a couple of platters and a whole box full of forks and knives and spoons. And then you see that, because most people don't follow the price of silver. They don't have, they don't think they have any, right? And then they see, oh my God, it's over $100 an ounce. Then they think, we got grandma's silverware that we could sell. But how motivating is that? Like, does that really make somebody run down to the basement, pull that stuff off, dust it off, test it to see if it really is silver? Oh, it's just sterling on it, and then bring it to a recycler of some sort. Everybody has a different degree of urgency, motivation, whatever. As the price goes up, then it keeps reminding people, and then at some point somebody takes out a calculator. Geez, I wonder if grandma's silverware is 10 pounds. Okay, so that's 160 ounces, which is not quite true because that would be Avoirdupois ounces, not troy ounces, but close enough. Okay, 160 ounces, $100 an ounce is $16,000. Oh shit, right? So then, but everybody's on a different place in the cycle. How long does it take them to realize that? Think about that. How many people need that 16,000 versus how many? It's like the 16,000 doesn't really make that much difference to their life. Might as well keep it. Who knows? It'll go higher, or whatever people say. So bit by bit, that silver is drawn out. But it could take a while. Now, in terms of mining, most silver is produced as a byproduct of something else. So Monetary Metals made a silver loan to it's publicly traded. It's a company called Bunker Hill. The asset is in northern Idaho. It trades on TSXV. And that is a lead zinc silver mine. And yeah, it produces plenty of silver, but really it's a byproduct of lead and zinc. And so, those projects don't get created or ramp up more just because of the price of the silver component of what they produce is going up in price. There are some pure play silver mines, but getting a whole new mine into production, that's years. And in silver, most of the mines are producing as a byproduct, so it's relatively immune to that. And so, yeah, I think the silver price could really run. Now, at the moment, with backwardation, you expect higher prices. So that's where we're at in terms of, you said, is it early, is it middle, is it late? It's definitely not late, in my view.
So if we don't look at, or if we're not taking the production deficit as the basis for investing in silver, what is the more quality argument to be made to be making that investment, Keith?
I mean, in lay terms, I think you're getting substitution of silver for gold. Gold's out of reach for a lot of the population of the world. And even in the US, suppose you are a skilled blue collar, trade. You're the shop foreman in a machine shop. You're the, site supervisor for a bunch of framers and construction jobs or something. And you're stacking silver. So you're taking home $1,000 to $1,500 a week, maybe. I don't know exactly what that wage would be, but something in that vicinity. So you want to take 10% of that and put that into gold. So $100 to $150, right? That's a tiny, tiny fraction of an ounce of gold. And you're not going to get very much for it. So it's not emotionally satisfying. I mean, you can buy like, a fraction of a gram. They call it a bar, but it's really a little chip floating. So it's called a Certi card. It's about the size of a credit card, right? And it has this little clear plastic window in it, which is thicker than the credit card. Inside that window is a little fleck of gold. It's not emotionally satisfying. You hold a 1 ounce gold coin, it's so heavy. You can sort of feel the tangible reality to it. Anyway, this little fleck doesn't have any of that emotional, connection. And there's
That
this
emotional
bank.
gravity, if you will.
Yeah, right, exactly. And on top of that, you pay a gigantic premium for gold in such, small, precise quantities. So it's not really a particularly good deal because when you go to sell it, you won't necessarily recover that premium. And so the bid-offer spread is, pretty wide for small amounts of gold versus silver. And so the higher the gold price goes, the more that people are forced to substitute silver. Now, if U.S. skilled, tradespeople aren't really in a position to afford, gold with their weekly wage, just imagine how it is. Wages would be a lot lower in Europe, a lot lower than, in Turkey would be lower than Europe, India much lower than Turkey. Silver is really what it comes down to for them. So, but of course, that's historically what it always was. Kings and wealthy merchants had gold. And here we are today, and that's not just kings, obviously, but affluent, knowledge workers, if they're stacking, they can buy gold. Right? If you are a AI, machine learning expert, so software engineer, data scientist, digital signal processing engineer, those guys could be drawing two, three, $400,000 a year. And the weekly wage, you could buy, if you set aside 10% of it, you still probably buy an ounce of gold, or something like that, if you want to. So, and obviously, people in their own businesses, have the money. So that's. The world is sort of reverting to that in a way.
So, Keith, what do you think all this volatility means for the continued adoption of both gold and silver as money? We saw some nearly 10% moves recently in the price of gold in a day, almost 20% in silver. And the metals have always been something that, or especially gold, is something that touts itself as being low volatility. So, is this a particular symptom of, the dollar going off the rails, as you mentioned earlier? Or, how do we try to consider the volatility of the last 2 months here?
I mean, the volatility is not good. You look at all the different participants in the market, there's really only one participant that benefits from volatility, and that's the day trader. Somebody who's stabbing in quick and right back out just as quick. And if they get it right and a little bit of luck and a little bit of timing, they can make a killing. But in terms of anybody who's trying to use it as money, obviously money and volatility are, I get into it with a Bitcoiner sometimes on Twitter. Money and volatility are mutually exclusive. So now what clearly happened, most especially in silver, is when you have a one-way market, it just goes up every day because the fundamentals were there. Then, people could see that. Everybody with a chart, which is pretty much everybody in the universe, can see that. And people jump in with leverage. They start buying silver futures. And, futures give you about 20-to-1 leverage if you want it. So you can command quite a lot of metal for not that much capital down. And so once that happens, then the price gets ahead of whatever the fundamentals may be. And then, of course, that drives the price further, and more people can smell the momentum, and they pile in. Everyone's piling in. At that point, it's baked in the cake that it's got to crash, because, the thing about people who buy with leverage is that's by nature a short-term trade, right? Either you're going to get out because you take your profits because it went up, or you're going to get out, you're forced out because you're going to take your losses, your stop loss. And it's expensive to carry metal in the futures market. You're paying at the moment there's not a contango. Normally it's contango, so it's a short term traders market, and you get more and more leverage by more and more short term traders, and then it's just inevitable. It's a bug looking for a windshield, or a balloon looking for a pin, that at some point it finds it, and the price ticks down. And then the first guy hits a stop loss and he sells, and that causes another downtick, and then hits the next guy, and you cascade all the way down from $126, I think, down to, 70 something. I mean, a massive, massive, massive loss. But it was baked in the cake at that point. I mean, maybe not necessarily that magnitude, but it had to. Mm-hmm. And then, there it is. And so, of course, people are feeling stung, they're feeling burned. Never go back to silver again, all the promises that people make that they're probably not going to keep. And when the price is turning around and going back up, you get that again. So it's because the dollar is falling, everybody wants to pile into the metals, and then that piling into the metals causes the price to rise enough where the traders are piling in, not as a way to avoid the dollar, but as a way to make more dollars, regardless of what narrative they tell themselves. The whole point is to make more dollars.
Right.
And so they do that, and the ones that are early to the party, especially if they're early to leave, just as they were early to enter, they make money, or make dollars anyway. The ones that are late to the party, get creamed and get carried out a body bag.
So what should we consider an acceptable, let's say, volatility delta for something that should be considered money?
I mean, the less the better. You want your money to be boring and stable. And I always point out to the Bitcoiners, Bitcoin is not a store of value even during phase one skyrocketing. And of course, phase one skyrocketing is always followed by phase two crashing. Mm-hmm. So the less skyrocketing we have, the less crashing we're going to have, and that benefits people, on both sides, right? So, if currency is going to be used as a medium of exchange, there are people accepting the currency. Now, if you think about businesses, unfortunately, most of the people who are playing with gold are retail investors, institutions generally. It's changing now, but historically and generally, it's not been an institutional market in terms of buying it and holding it. It's not how institutions work. And it's retail. So retail people tend to think that all the other participants are just like retail, but it's not, it's not the case. Suppose you're a car dealership, and I ran this thought experiment with Bitcoin. It's Friday evening, and, you sell a brand new Ford F-150 Raptor. And someone pays one Bitcoin when Bitcoin is the right price for that vehicle. Okay. And now, you know, over the weekend, you're selling more cars, whatever. Monday morning, the finance manager comes back to the dealership and, you know, you have to settle up with Ford Motor Company. You're not settling like Friday night at 9:30 p.m. You know, the dealership may still be open in California, but there's no settlement anymore. They're just selling cars and whatever, right? Monday morning, they go to settle. Oops, you're 20% shy of what you need to pay Ford. Completely unacceptable. And so, you know, think about 2 or 3 days and the volatility can get to the point where, you know, the dealer could be ruined if it did that on any number of cars. And conversely, if the price goes up, anybody that owed or promised, okay, you know, on Friday we agree, I'll pay you a Bitcoin for something and you deliver it to me on Monday, and on Monday I have to pay you. If the price goes up, I'm screwed. So let alone, you know, financing business, which is a very, very important thing. If business can't be financed, then business collapses down to the level of, you know, one man workshop or maybe a family farm. In other words, a medieval village. Nothing larger than that can really exist without finance. And so, you know, if you have this thing that's volatile, if it's going up, it makes no sense to borrow. If it's going down, it makes no sense to keep your savings in it. Bitcoin has both, and of late, certainly silver has had that in spades, and gold, you know, to some degree. So it is a disincentive for its use, you know, in a more serious, you know, financially. Now, for monetary metals clients, all this creates an incentive to use it, because if you're a jeweler and you lease the metal from us rather than trying to borrow currency, you're avoiding that mismatch where, you know, you have a currency liability and you have a gold asset in your store. That mismatch is the cause of all the troubles. So if you don't do that mismatch, then, you know, life's a heck of a lot easier. So this volatility has brought a great deal more business to us from companies that now understand at a very intuitive, you know, sort of perceptual, self-evident level of why, you know, if you have gold, you want to finance it in gold and not in currencies. But I'd say overall, the volatility is not a good thing, but it's part and parcel of the system going off the rails. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that fundamental argument for Bitcoin has actually changed, Keith, or are more people just kind of realizing that it's more, that it behaves more like a speculative tech stock?
That's an interesting question. You know, I remember the beginning days, and not even the beginning, but I started to write negatively about it around 2013, I think. And they were telling me at the time, well, Bitcoin has the fastest adoption curve of any technology. Look at the automobile, look at the television, look at the PC, look at the internet, look at wireless phones, look at Facebook, look at Twitter, right? Each one was adopted faster and faster, got to, you know, 60% or whatever, 75% market share. And the Bitcoiners have stopped using that argument because it's still, you know, low single digits of people who've even traded it, let alone if you want to actually use the word adoption, whatever that means. So the arguments keep pivoting, you know, from one to the next to the next. None of them really make any sense. None of them are actually true. Well, it's digital gold. Well, it's storage of energy. It's storage of, you know, just blah, 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 whatever they think is going to stick. And I think, yeah, there are some people that are like, you know what, this isn't working. And then they just, you know, okay, I made some money, you know, and they walk away. I think it's at that point. Mm-hmm.
So, Keith, going back to the dollar and its use kind of as a contrast for all of these other monies or currencies, does this mean that the end of the dollar is near?
It's getting nearer, you know, in the same way that the Pink Floyd song Time, you know, was another trip around the sun and one day closer to death. Yeah, we're getting closer. I don't think the dollar's death is quite as close as most gold people would probably think it is. And I've revised my own view. I mean, in 2012, I thought we were 5 to 7 years away. And that turned to be wildly off. Obviously, here we are 7 years after the end of that range. And yeah, it's got more time, which is good. Nobody should want to see that. It's going to be a calamity when that happens. And frankly, monetary metals is attempting to avert that disaster. And right now we're not big enough to move that needle. I'm hoping that we can scale fast enough to actually move that needle and avert that. But I think that's years off in the dollar. I think you'll see other currencies, especially at the periphery, fail. Whether that's the lira, whether that's one of the Asian currencies, not the yuan, not just yet, or some other marginal currency. Look at 2008. I mean, the Icelandic, what is it, krona, almost collapsed. I mean, they had all kinds of problems in marginal little currency like that. Yes, there, but not in the dollar, not yet, no.
What do you think the new Fed chair is going to have to do with how the dollar behaves from here? Obviously, this is,
Less?
a lot of speculation, but.
Yeah, I mean, anyone, man, they can. The trend for interest rates is falling. The trend for the debt is exponential growth. The trend for quantity of dollars is exponential growth. And it doesn't really matter whether Tweedledee or Tweedledum is the Fed chair. It makes no difference. Those things are happening. Every once in a while, they decide, either because they believe their own rhetoric or because they're desperate to prove to the world that they still have any power, try to reverse the falling. And that's we're in the middle of this attempt right now to reverse the falling interest rate. And every time they do that, they precipitate a crisis because the marginal business cannot pay. Higher interest rate requires ever lower interest rates. And so, they try to hike it and then they get a crisis and debt defaults. And, everyone looks at GDP and employment, but upstream of that is credit. If somebody's being squeezed into default, all the rest of those things will happen and banks will curtail lending, which means other companies are squeezed into default and so on. And you get a 2008 if you persist at it. So, if the Fed doesn't want that, sooner or later they're going to have to reverse course, go right back down to zero and beyond. And on top of that, we know that Trump wants much lower interest rates. That's his stated thing. In his first term, there was a video of him in some sort of room, and somebody mentioned something, what do you think of European negative interest rates? And he said, yeah, give me some of that free money. I know how to spend it. And then he got some applause. And he said, yeah, see, the smart people in the room understand. It's good. We can borrow more at ever cheaper rates. And I was just like, this is not good. So he wants lower rates. He picked Kevin Warsh, who kind of has a reputation as being a hawk. To me, the hawks and the doves, I just have to go on one of my little rants. It's a false alternative. It's kind of the two prison guards that are beating you, and one of them has a leather belt that he uses to beat you, and the other one fills a sock with sand to beat you. And we're arguing as to which kind of beating is less inhumane or something. I don't know. The hawks and the doves, because they're both doing it to you with central planning and a central bank. But be that as it may. He has a reputation as being a hawk and stands for higher interest rates, but he's in a multi-decade falling interest rate trend, reporting to a president who wants lower interest rates. So what do you think is going to survive? His reputation as wanting higher rates, or the market's need and the president's demand for lower rates? That's a pretty obvious, pretty obvious call.
And I think it's interesting to kind of be able to have the, let's say, the cover to say, oh, he's a hawk. This must mean we really need this stimulus package, right?
Yeah, I suppose I hadn't really thought of it that way. I suppose you could, you could pick him for that reason, negotiating with him privately, like, hey, look, if I point US Fed, you got to lower rates. Okay, sure, whatever. Anything for power. And then, right, you have the cover. Hawke could do that. I remember people said, only Nixon, it took a Republican to come to rapprochement with China. A Democrat couldn't do that.
Well, Keith, I think that's a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about or consider before we wrap up?
I'm kind of on a kick right now of saying to people, be curious. There's so many things, I mean, not just politically, but just focusing on the monetary issue. There's so many things that are just, everyone just says blah, blah, blah. Oh yeah, the price of gold goes up if they increase the quantity of money. The data is all out there, man. You can get any graph on any time frame you want. You can get a graph of the gold price. There's an incredible resource. The Federal Reserve itself, the St. Louis Fed, publishes a site called FRED. I don't know what that stands for. I believe it's an acronym. FRED publishes M0 money supply, M1, M2, M3 up to a certain point. Take a look at these things and see if that correlation that everybody treats as a given, and verify for yourself whether you think that correlation is real. Alleged correlation is real. Be curious. There's so many things that are just offered as platitudes. The latest one, I think I tweeted about it. Tariffs were promised to pay off the deficit, which is sort of a nonsense term anyway, but that was sort of the promise, right? And now that obviously it didn't, and obviously deficits are as big or bigger than ever, nobody's curious. Nobody goes back and says, wait a minute, what was anybody thinking to say that? They're just on to the next, on to the next, on to the next. Just like, doom scrolling on Facebook. Be curious. Ask those questions. That is by far, I'm not saying listen to me, but of course I think you should listen to me. But more importantly, ask questions. And don't stop until you get answers that make sense. And, does this match this? If not, why not? Early monetarists, there was a guy named Knut Wicksell in the 1890s who set out to measure the money supply and the general price level. And he expected to be able to prove that the general price level correlated with the money supply. It's not what he found. What he found was the price level correlated with interest rate, not the quantity of money. And then later, a guy named Gibson, was talking about this. It's now called Gibson's paradox. Gibson's paradox is all but forgotten because this finding is not convenient to modern monetary economics. They want everyone to think that, oh yeah, inflation comes from an increase in quantity. It's not true. Be curious. Ask questions and demand the answers. And if no one will give you the answer, do the research and see what you can find. If everybody was just curious, the world would be a better place. So that's my
Well,
closing remark.
I like it. I like the idea of questioning everything. And of course, FRED stands for Federal Reserve Economic Data. For anybody that wants to check out the 2026 Gold Outlook, we'll have the link to it in the show notes. And of course, that's also more of your writing and stuff is also available at monetary-metals.com. And of course, on X at Real Keith Weiner. Keith, thanks so much for your time. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Tom.